Thank you, Ed. My name is Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. And as I always do when I get up here, I get a little nervous for about 2 minutes. And I came well supported from my group from Brandon, all in this section over here. That made me feel good, and to see them coming down, it really made me feel real good to know that the support that I have. I believe that we all have a mirror in our life, and I believe that sometime or another we have to look at that mirror. We have to look at who we are, what we are. I had to. Where am I going? What am I doing? And so I like to tell my story. It starts out in a hot July morning, and I had just finished a 4th of July drunk weekend, and the alarm went off. It was about 6 o'clock, and the sun was coming through the window, and I shut the alarm off, and I brushed my head, and I tried to find out, what day is this? Do I have another day's vacation coming to me? Do I have to go into work today? Can I call in sick? Now, these are spontaneous thoughts that go through my mind as the alarm went off. So I reached over and I shut the alarm, and I laid there for a while and trying to compose myself, and I felt a very blunt arm come across and punch me. And it was my wife telling me to get out of bed. And I put my feet on the cold floor, the parquet floor, and I reached over and I smoked Lucky Strikes at that time, and I lit up as Lucky Strike, and I put my hand in my head, and I was smoking a cigarette, and I said, oh my God, another day, another day. And I went into the bathroom, and I looked at that mirror of truth that I had to see myself, who I was, and look at myself and say, I'm so tired of being who I am. And then I put my face on the tile floor because of the coolness of the tile. And I reached and I started to shave. And as I shaved, I shook like a leaf. And I was 24 years old. And I had to prepare myself for the working force, for the world, the subways and everything else. And I was full of fear again. My alcoholism was mostly fear. I suffered a lot of fear. The fear of the unknown, the fear of what was happening. There was tremendous fear I had through alcohol. And as I looked in the mirror, I said, well, and I looked at my wife. She was sprawled across the bed, and she was about 4 months pregnant. And I said, I disappointed her again. I disappointed her again. And I had made her 1,000 promises, and I broke every single one of them. I used every single gimmick that I could think of. There was so many things in our lives that I tried, and we were only married about 3 years at the time. I got on a train and I was going to work, and I said, I remember something about that there was a place for help, and it was called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had remembered that when I read the newspaper going into work, whenever I saw an excerpt on alcoholism at that time, I would tear it out, and when I got to the men's room at work, I would read it. And I remembered at one time I went into on a subway in New York. There was a little caboose there, area there. And I went in there and read this here article on alcoholism. And it said it was a very short article, and I even remember the doctor that wrote it, Dr. Van Dellen. And I turned around and I said, when I read the article, it said, there is only one source of help that's proven successful up until this time, and it's a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, yeah, but I'm not an alcoholic. I said, I'm not like Uncle John. Uncle John was a policeman who was arrested for police brutality in 1945, which was unheard of. Uncle John stole newspapers. Uncle John stole radios out of his own house. He stole the toaster. And he'd do anything to get a drink, Uncle John. And I wasn't Uncle John. And then I thought of Uncle Neil, and Uncle Neil came back from World War II, and he was a recluse, and he stayed in the house, and he drank, and he drank, and he was a drunk. He was an alcoholic. But you see, at that time, I was an up-and-rising young executive in a company. I was 24 years old. I had my own home by this time. I had a nice brand-new car sitting in the driveway. I had a lovely wife who was pregnant. By the way, you know, when she told me that she was pregnant, you know the thought I had, the first thought I had in my mind was that in 7 months I'm going on a 10-day drunk. That shows you how sick I was. At that time, a woman would go into the hospital for 10 days when they gave birth. And I thought about that, and I said, wow, I'll be able to be free for 10 days to get drunk for 10 days. That's the first thought I had about the good news that my wife was bringing me, that she was going to have a baby. So I thought about this, and I went into work, and I was, as I told you, I shook a lot by this time. I thought I beat this alcohol. I really did. Before this time, I was always getting sick. I was always throwing up. And I stopped throwing up and getting sick. And then this other thing creeped in that I didn't know about, and I started to walk around like this all the time. As I told you, I smoked Lucky Strikes, and I had a white shirt. And people in the office would say, you got a cigarette? And I said, no. And there was the red circle right through the red white shirt. And he said, it's in your pocket. I said, oh, here, and I throw it down. I was so ashamed to go in my pocket to hand him the cigarette, to hand him, to give him the cigarette, that I throw it on the desk and have them take their own cigarette. Well, I went into work, and I got through until 12 o'clock, and I said, I'm going to look up this Alcoholics Anonymous. So right on the corner of 41st Street and 6th Avenue, there was a cigar store. And I went in there, and I was looking up Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going through the book, and I was going through the telephone book, and I couldn't find it. I really couldn't find it. Some lady came over to me. Today, I believe she was an angel. I really do. Because she said, can I help you? You're looking for something, and you look frustrated. And I said, I'm looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. And she immediately went to AL. I was looking under AA Trucking, AA Vending, AA Business. All that, that's what I was looking for. And I thought that was fantastic that she went right to it. And she gave me the address and telephone number of Intergroup on 39th Street, Manhattan. And I went back to work, and I sweated the rest of the day. And I made up my mind I was going to check out Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked over to 39th Street, and I stood on the corner, and I spied the building. It was a brownstone building. And I was waiting for all the derelicts of Alcoholics Anonymous to fall down the stairs into this brownstone. I was waiting for people, drunks, to go in there, and I didn't see anybody fitting my description of what I thought somebody should look like in Alcoholics Anonymous. They were well-dressed people. They were, happy-looking people. So I walked past there a couple of times, and it was down in the basement of this brownstone, and as I went by, I sneaked a peek in. And there was a chair and a table and a desk and a man there. And I walked around the corner, went back up to 39th Street and Lexington Avenue, and there was the biggest sign in the world that said B-A-R. And I said, I know what I need. I need a couple of drinks to give me the courage to get down there. I always needed a couple, always a couple. Oh, and then I had a brilliant thought. If you want to stop drinking, why do you want to drink? And you know, in my confused alcoholic mind, the state I was in, this made a lot of sense to me. So I had given up God about, I thought he gave me up, but I gave him up about a year prior to this, because I remember in a church one time in Manhattan begging God to stop me from drinking and then going out and drinking. I would beg him for many things and then go ahead and do what I wanted to do by using my own will. So I turned around in all my defiance of God. At this point, standing on this corner, I turned around and I said, if there is a God in heaven, throw me down those stairs because I can't do it on my own. And you know, I stand up here today and I really, really believe I wasn't thrown down the stairs, but I had a blackout. I have no recollection of walking down 39th Street, and I have no recollection of walking into Intergroup. The only thing I recall is I was sitting at a desk and this man was telling me his story, which was my story, the exact same story of an alcoholic. The fear, the uncertainty of life, the uselessness, the isolation of life, all these things he's talking to me about, and I'm sitting there and I'm still shaking from the weekend. And he turned around to me and he said, I want you to go to a meeting tonight, and it's out in Flatbush. I said, well, I don't live around there. He said, well, you'll find him, won't you? I said, oh, yeah, sure. He gave me, he instilled hope with me that night, that afternoon, that there was hope when he spoke to me, you know. And the amazing part is, you know, that I see it today, that in my culture, my area, I never associated with black people because it was another area, see? And this man was a black man who was telling me all about himself, and his name was Jay Sims, I'll never forget him. And I was the same as him. And this impressed me, the way I felt at that time. So I went and I left there, and I had a spark of a little joy to know that there was some hope. And I got on the subway, and he gave me directions how to get to the Flatbush meeting. And I got on the subway, and I went home, and my wife was sprawled across the bed, and she was probably crying all day. And I came in, and I said to her, I said, Joan, I found it. I found what I've been looking for my whole life. And she just tilted her head up a little bit and said, you found another gimmick. And you know, I didn't even know it, but I didn't know if I did find another gimmick, because I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I couldn't blame her. I left there, and I started my journey to go to my first AA meeting. And it was like this. You went downstairs. It was in a church. I followed the directions, and the man that Jay Sims, who gave me the directions, he told me to get there at 7:30, and the meetings in New York didn't start till 9. See, but I didn't know about the AA Underground. So I got there, and I was the second car in the parking lot. So I sat there, and it was 8 o'clock, and another car pulled in, and I said, well, suppose I have the wrong place. Then I won't have much time to find the meeting. So I said, I better go downstairs. So I went down the steep stairway, and as I walked in the door in the back, there was a coffee place up here where they were making coffee, and a man turned around and said, hey, Charlie, we've been waiting for you. Come on down here. And I said, how does he know my name? I didn't know that Jay Sims called him, and he's the coffee maker, and he's the first one there. I knew all that later on, but I felt, holy mackerel, how did they know me, you know? And I came into the meeting, and I saw the people coming in just like they did tonight. A lot of smiles, a lot of laughter, and they were shaking hands with one another. And I stood off to the corner by the coffee machine there, and I watched them in awe. I saw all this here. Something, there must be a cult or something that's going on here. There's something wrong. I've never seen people like this in my life. And I stood there and I watched them come in, and a guy came up to me. He said, well, just sit at the meeting and what you don't like. And then they got a guy up here, and he read the preamble, and he turned around and he said that we have no booze or fleas, you know, and we're not allied with any sect, you know. And I thought he said sex, and there's men and women here. And I'm looking around, and it's all confusion. It's a massive confusion to me, my first AA meeting. But then I turn around, and the meeting's about to start, and they ask me to sit down between a couple of people. And a couple of people, I said, I'm not going to remember all your names. I can't possibly. And they go, my name's Bill. And I said, oh, my goodness. So I sat there, and I don't remember too much of the meeting, except one speaker got up. He was a New York City policeman, and I could relate to him because of one reason. He got up, and he said he had a blackout, and in his blackout, he kicked in a door in his house or apartment, and he had a wife behind there who had a two-month-old baby in her arms, and he damaged the baby off very seriously. And I said, and he said he did it in a blackout. And I said, I've always had blackouts. I've never considered myself drunk unless I had a blackout. So I knew I was kind of in the right place. But I looked around, and there were a lot of old people there, older. You know, I was 24 years old. And I was probably one of the youngest ones around at that time. It does my heart good when I see so many young people today that they got what a chance out of life. I've led a fantastic life through Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't want to live my life over unless I lived it through Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of the most fascinating life I could have possibly asked for. But I went to my, then I went to a meeting in my home group, and they introduced me, and I loved the meetings. I loved the people in the meetings. There was a spirit here. There was something that I couldn't put my hand on. I couldn't touch it. You can't taste it. You can't smell it. There's something in the room for me. And I looked around. I watched all these people, and I watched them from a distance, and I watched this guy and that guy, and the compassion they had for one another. And I was in my area. There was a lot of longshoremen from Brooklyn, and to see these real tough guys, longshoremen, down these meetings, you know. And they put their arm around me and say, you got a maid, kid, you got a maid, you know, and stuff like that. And it made me feel good. It really made me feel good. It was like a fatherly image most of them had towards me. And I grew in the program, and gradually I grew, and I was just so happy to be sober, all right? And then I couldn't get up and speak. They keep asking me, come on, you got to get up and speak. I said, no, I can't. I said, I'm so full of fear. I said, I could never get up here and talk. I could never do that. And then my wife gave birth to that baby we were talking about. She's 38 years old today. And she gave birth to that baby, and it was a snowy night, and it was a Saturday night, and I was so high, man, I was flying out of boxes, cigars on the one hand, a box of candy down the other, and I was going down to my buddy's VAA meeting, and I was going to give out cigars and candy and all, and I get down there, and they would pat me on the shoulder and everything else, and then they said, and they said, you know, the speakers didn't show up. I said, I'll speak. No. Man, that was great. All right. I got up there and I gave my story for the first time. My wife heard my story about 50 times before. I kept saying, hey, you gotta listen to my story. Someday I'm gonna have to tell it. And so the new baby was born, and a new age in my life had started through Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober 14 months at the time, and you know, I know this must happen to a lot of people in the program. You get restless and tired, and I started to get, I started to take on an attitude. Is that all there is to it, just staying sober? No. I'd go down to meetings, and I'd be gradually drifting towards the back row of the meeting hall, and I'd be turning around and saying, is that all there is? God, I can't get anything out of this program. I'm not getting anything out of this anymore. Oh, it was fun. I was sober. And then came the time that I desperately wanted to drink, and I desperately wanted to stay sober at the same time. And I went down to the meeting. I said, well, I'll go down to the meeting this night. And I sat the last row, the last seat, over by the door. And I sat there. And it was a step meeting. It was the fourth step. And it went around. And everybody in the room had such wisdom to say about the fourth step. The man led the meeting. And it was so beautiful that it made me sick. Because I never had anything to say about the fourth step. So I left the meeting before the Lord's Prayer. And I got in a car, and I drove the highways and byways, desperately wanting to drink on Long Island, back and forth, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, not being able to make a decision, and not having the humility to go into somebody and say, hey man, I'm hurting. I don't know what's going on in me. What's going on inside of me? I don't know. I don't understand it. I want to talk to you. I didn't have that humility. I had to do this on my own. I had to do it because I had the face of the happy member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything was okay, and I was dying inside during this time, but I wouldn't share me with any of you. So I drove the highways, and I came home that night, and I got on my knees. This is my first contact with God since I told you I left him. And I got on my knees, and I turned around, and I said, give me the ability to make a decision. Just let me make a decision whether to drink or stay sober. I really don't care which one it is at this point. And I sat on the chair and I fell asleep. And I woke up the next day, and I never had a desire to drink for many, many years after that. It was gone. Okay? I was sober about 17 or 18 months, and I was sitting in a meeting, and something happened in the meeting from up in the platform or something. And I started to laugh hysterically. I couldn't stop laughing. I had to put a handkerchief. I disrupted the whole meeting. I had to put a handkerchief. You know, for many, many years as an active alcoholic, I walked around with a frown and slanty eyes, and I always looked as though I was going to have a fight with somebody if they said the wrong thing to me. And I carried this into Alcoholics Anonymous for about 14 or 15 months that I did this. And this night, it broke. I had a spiritual awakening. I believe it was my first one in Alcoholics Anonymous because I started to laugh. And it was uncontrollable laughter, and I had to get up, and I walked out. And every time I came back to sit down at the meeting, I started to laugh again, and it felt good. It felt so good to know that I was capable of laughing, and I got a great joy out of that. I went on to, in the program I went, and I was sober 10 years, and I was at a meeting again. And the reason I bring these up is because I want to illustrate something that the power is in the meeting. This is where the power takes place. The power is God, and it is love. And what we have, this binding that goes on between us here, is so powerful that we have no idea how powerful it is. I've only come to realize this after many, many years of sobriety, the power that's in these rooms. And I'll tell you why. I was sober 10 years, and when people would get up and say, I love my wife, I love my kids, I love my job, I love, I love, I love, I would get them after the meeting and say, what do you mean, love? I said, I don't know what that experience is. What are you talking about, love? And they would go on to give their ideas what love was. And I couldn't get it in my head. I couldn't understand it. And it went on and on. I didn't dwell on it or anything else. It's just that I was so curious, why didn't I have this experience? So after 10 years of sobriety, I was leading a meeting in Queens, and I sat up here, I was sitting at a desk, and I was talking, and all of a sudden, I understood what love was. And I started to cry. I hadn't cried probably since I was a child. And a full room of people was sitting there and watching this guy cry, and they probably said, this guy's flipped out. But again, I had another experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it happened right in the rooms of the program. And for this, I'm grateful. I led a fantastic life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did so many things. I enjoyed so many people. I was a counselor in Connecticut. I was up at Second Chance. I was up at the High Watch. I met some of the greatest people in the world, greatest people in the world. And they remained friends for many, many years in the program. And this here friendship grew and grew. I was sober 25 years, and I left and I came to Florida. It was a time in the life that it was time to move on, and I always wanted to move to Florida, and I moved to Florida, sober 25 years at the time I came to Florida, and I went to some meetings when I came. It's an age-old story, and I went to meetings, and I wasn't comfortable. You know, in New York, everybody knew me. You know, everybody knew Charlie. And I didn't know anybody here. And I sat at the meetings, and Joanne's husband, Don, said to me one night, he said, how about leading the Carver Street meeting, speaking to the Carver Street meeting on January such and such Saturday night? I said, oh, sure. This was in November. I said, oh, sure. I'll be glad to. Yeah. That day came, okay, and I turned around and I said to myself, I don't want to speak at that meeting. I'm not going to speak at that meeting. I'm not even going to call him. And I didn't go to that meeting, and I stopped going to meetings at that time. When I stopped going to meetings, I said to myself, look, you're sober 25 years. You know what it's all about. You've been a counselor. You know this program inside out. You've done everything possible in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to go no more. The denial started. I believe that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, our recovery is physical, mental, and spiritual, the first three steps. As I see it now, my relapse was in the reverse order. Spiritually, I walked away from God. I stopped praying in the morning, and I stopped thanking God at night for keeping me sober for today. I just stopped. And then all of a sudden, the sanity part of my life, this is all before picking up a drink, the sanity part of my life was that I was taking on attitudes. I was taking on attitudes of arrogance, of anger, and they were all slipping back in, and so deceitful that I could not recognize the change that was taking place in myself. So then I have a catering truck, and I go around to different sites and all, and so I was in Pace to go shopping, and I walked by, and there was a cardboard of Bartle and James, you know, the good old boys. And I looked at them, and I said, see, they look like good old boys there, you know, the wine cooler. I said, I never heard of wine cooler. So I walked by, and I didn't pay much attention. And the next time I walked in, I said, wine cooler? I said, oh, my God, it's only got about 12% alcohol. That's look, peach, apple, cinnamon, all the kind of exotic flavors they have. That's wonderful. I put it down. And the next time I went into Pace, I said, where's Bartle and James? They moved the display. And I didn't know where it was. So I went looking for the display of Bartle and James. And I found it. And I said, wow. I said, I wonder how one would taste. And I took one off the shelf, and I thought the whole world was watching Jolly. Everybody in the store was looking at me. And I put it on the shopping cart, and I piled everything on top. I bought stuff I didn't even need to cover up these four bottles in a pack. And I got out to my truck, and I got a big cooler, and I fill it up with ice, and I'm shaking like a leaf, shaking like a leaf. And I go, and I pop the cork on it, and I sit in my truck, and I pour it, and I taste it, and I say, that is very refreshing. I hadn't smoked in 12 years. I reached over and picked up a cigarette out of a pack. I cracked a pack of cigarettes and lit a cigarette at the same time. Insanity? I'm telling you. I got on 301 highway, and there was a state trooper about 5 miles away, and I got so scared I threw the drink out the window. I was not going to get caught with a DUI, not in Florida. Okay? And I got home, and I stashed the three bottles in the back of the truck, inside the truck, and maybe I took them for a couple of days. Maybe it took me a week to drink the three bottles. Maybe. I don't remember that much about it, but maybe it took it 3 weeks. But the way I wound up was that my daughter, Robin, one of my daughters, we used to go out to Wags every Saturday morning, go to different restaurants around town. And she sat there at she was about 16 at the time, 16, 17. She said, Daddy, there's something taking place in you. I don't understand it. You're changing. You used to have so many friends. And you're always a happy person. She said, what's happening to you? She said, I'm scared. There's something. I said, I'm going through a changed life. So she said, yeah, but maybe you should go back to where all your friends are. In Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, oh no, I've gone through that stage. The denial in my life was so strong that I still can't believe it today, the denial that I had in my life. So I went on. The way I wound up was that I graduated to vodka. I never tasted vodka. I drank vodka, and I started to drink gin. And I was a sneak for quite a while. I got away with it for quite a while. I became a buzz drink, I called myself, and then I became a drunk for life. And AA taught me how to have control in my life through the working of the steps and how to use the steps and utilize the program and things like that. I knew how my life was supposed to be when I was in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. But as soon as I took a drink, as soon as I picked up a drink, I was all over the place. I couldn't control myself. I couldn't. All the character defects that I arrested for so many years, every one of them came to the surface. Every one of them came up again. And I didn't know how to control my life anymore. My life was out of control completely through this alcohol, through the drinking. So I went and I bought a bottle of vodka, and I cracked it at 12, 1 o'clock, and I put it in a brown paper bag, and I drank some of it, and I went in the house. I came back at 3:30 in the afternoon. I figured I'd have a drink before my wife comes home. So I go out and to the truck, and I pick up the bottle of vodka. It was a quart of vodka, and it was light. So I said, gee, maybe I broke it. I took the bag off it, and the bottle was empty. The bottle was completely bone dry, and I couldn't understand it. I said, how did it leak? I couldn't believe that I drank that much. Yeah. At the same time, I didn't want anybody in town to know what I was drinking. Nobody even knew me, you know. That was all the fears I had of myself. But I went down to, I live in Brandon, and I went down to 92, Highway 92, and I took 92 into Plant City to go to a liquor store. Sorry, how sick I am. To go to a liquor store, and I pick up a half a pint, and I drink it. I don't even get halfway back to Brandon, and the bottle is gone. And I said, I got to go all the way back to Plant City, pick up another half a pint. That's crazy. I'll go the other direction, you know, just to get a drink. It was so wild. So I, my wife, really was, I can imagine, I did this at the best time of our lives, financially, physically. We had our own home. The children were all grown up. They were all out there, had their own lives. I was a grandfather. The best time of my life. The best time of my life. It was all, you know, I couldn't understand it.
And then my brother came over one day, and my wife called him. My brother's in a program. He's in a long time. And he came over, and he said, "Man, you know what the score is. What am I going to tell you?" I said, "Let me tell you something. The arrogance that I had because of alcohol. You know, if somebody goes out and has a relapse, you can't really talk to them. You really can't until they have the desire to want to stop drinking. And I didn't have that desire." And my brother turned around, and he said to me, "Well, you know what the score is." I said, "Let me tell you something." I said, "I don't think I was ever an alcoholic, and I'm drunk." I said, "I think I was too young, and I wasn't mature enough, and that's why I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm falling off the chair there." He said, "Well, whatever, I'll pray for you." And he prayed for me. All right? Then my friend from New York calls me up, and he says, "Tell me Joan's a liar." That's my wife. I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Joan called up and said that you're drinking." He said, "Tell me Bill Wilson's drinking. Tell me anybody's drinking." He said, "I can't believe you're not. Is she gone crazy? Does she need help, you know?" And I said, "Look, Walter." I said, "You've been a good friend for so many years. Don't ruin our friendship. When I want to stop drinking, I'll stop drinking." He said, "Well, let me tell you." He said, "We're 1,400 miles away. And I'll tell you the same thing you told me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous 23 years ago." He said, "You were in Chicago. And I called you up and said, 'You've got to help me. And I'm on Long Island.' And I said, 'Walter, you got away with it yesterday, and you may have gotten away with it today, but you never know what's going to happen tomorrow.' He said, 'That exact words you said to me, and I'm telling them to you.' And he hung up. And you know, I stopped and I thought about that, and it was truth. And that night I went to my first AA meeting, and it was over in Brandon meeting after all this, and I sat there, and I wanted to die. I would rather have died than to be at that meeting. I really would. And I sat there, and I was scared. I was trembling. And when it came time for the white chip, I took a white chip. But I really didn't know if I was going to make it. I really didn't. That my pride, my ego, I had to come back. Everything I ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, once I pick up a drink, it was all gone. It was all gone. I had to start from day one and be fresh again and be new again in this program. And it was very, very hard. Very hard. So anybody that's coming back, I really have empathy towards you. I really understand what you're going through or could be going through if you are anything like me. Because I started to go to Claire Mel Group on a Tuesday night, and I dreaded that walk. There was a path going into Claire Mel Group. And just like it is over here, where we're all standing outside having cigarettes and talking and everything else, I had to walk down that path. And all these guys and girls are standing outside and they're talking. And sometimes I sat in the car and I waited till the meeting started so I could walk in. And I said, "This is not going to work. This is not going to work." And then I went and I decided to go to beginner's meetings because that was 7 o'clock. And there was nobody standing outside. So I started to go to beginnings meetings, and that's where I belonged. That's where I belong. I stayed in beginners meetings, and that's where I met my buddy Ed. And Ed, though he says I've been instrumental in helping him, he helped me tremendously, tremendously by just being a friend. And that's all I needed was a friend. Because I could have had anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I could have had any sponsors I wanted of anything. But I really needed somebody who was a friend, somebody who cared. And then I had some serious test taken, and a lady in the program called me up, Jane, and she was the only one, nobody knew me or anything else, but she called me up and she said, "I'm so concerned about you. I didn't see you at a meeting, one meeting." And that made me feel so good. So if you know somebody out there that's struggling to get back in this program, you don't have to preach or anything else. Just call them and tell them you care. And that made a world of difference to them, believe me, if they're anything like I am. And I felt just good to know that these people were there. And Ed and I have had a lot of fun. We've golfed all over. But my marriage, you know, I'll be married 41 years in November. And the marriage, it was ready for divorce. It was ready for divorce. This was 7.5 years ago. So I've been back 7.5 years. But it was, she just lost all hope in me and everything else. Took all the bank books, everything. She couldn't trust me. She had her own fear. I understand. I can understand it. But the marriage was terrible. It was a matter of just time where we were going to go our own ways and just try to live our own lives to the best of our abilities. And then we found golf. Now, what does that have to do with me? We decided to play golf together, and it was very strenuous at first to sit in the same cart, and we were both amateur golfers. At least we started to talk, and Ed encouraged that also, and we started to talk, and we started to talk, and today it's a lot better, a lot better, but it took about 6 years of a relapse and come back in this program to gain the faith that I have. I love my family. My family is very precious to me. We're very family-oriented because of Alcoholics Anonymous. They taught me how to be a family. I came from an alcoholic family. My father was an alcoholic. There was not much there, so that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and my first daughter wasn't even born yet, I felt a commitment. My children all went to meetings such as this, open meetings. They went through affairs and picnics and everything else. So they were taught about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can still hear it out of their mouths today. And, hey, first things first, you know. Easy does it. And you can hear them talking to their children now, my grandchildren. I sit at the table on Sunday at the head of the table, and my grandchildren fight to sit alongside of me. And as they get older, they got to move down to the other end, you know. And then the babies sit here. And that's a very precious thing to me, my family. My father didn't have a family. My father's an alcoholic. He had a lot of children. He had five children, but he never had a family. He was a very lonely man, full of despair. I understand that now. I didn't understand it growing up. He was a loner, and he lived to drink. He was a good father. He never abused us or anything else, but he didn't know how to be a person. He really didn't know how to be a person to his children, and I didn't want to be that way. I wanted to be a whole person to my children. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me these. Sobriety is just the frosting on it. Underneath, there's a power there that is so powerful. That if we touch into this power, if we start working the steps to our best of our ability, we have social contacts as well as AA contacts with our friends. If we build friendships in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went over to Europe because I spoke in France and they didn't understand what I was talking about, but that's all right. I was from Brooklyn anyway. I went to AA meetings in Norway and Sweden. It was fantastic. I've had a fantastic life. I have no regrets in my life. If I had to have that slip to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't encourage anybody else to do it, then I'm grateful I had the slip. I really am, because it brought me back here where I belong. You know, many years ago, God gave me a gift of sobriety, and at one time I got very religious, and I wanted to be a missionary and go to the missionary fields and everything else, and God said to me, I've given you a ministry, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Right in the doors of AA, there's plenty of hurting people as well as yourself. So I've enjoyed my life, and I hope you enjoy your life. I hope you get something out of something that I said. If you had a relapse, you know, man, it's tough, but fight it. Keep coming back because it's worth it. It's worth it when you come right through that tunnel and you come right out of that tunnel. I believe that just as we have the physical, mental, and spiritual part of our life in these three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've come to realize in my own philosophies, and you do build up your own philosophies in Alcoholics Anonymous that you do have, you know, some of them are off the wall, some are okay, but my philosophy is that we are physical, mental, and spiritual people. See, I believe that I was a very physical person from the time I was 15 till I was 30 years old. I had to have the fast cars. I had to have the good girls. I had to have the fast girls. I had to do everything. I was pushing to do everything at that age, right? And it was a good age. It was a fantastic age. I loved it, all right? And then from 30 to 45, I became a very mental person. I started to think about responsibility. I started to think about my children's education. I started to think about building homes. I started to build career and so forth. And so it was a very mental stage in my life. And it was a very important stage, very important. And then came the spiritual part of my life. And that started at the age of 50. And I'm 64, 63 years old today. And this is the best part of my life. Best part of my life spiritually, because I feel so good. And I look forward with excitement each day for what God has for me in each day that he brings me to this day. Today I feel like 25 again, without the fast cars and the fast girls. You know? But I still feel that good. spiritually, because now it's a spiritual person that I am. And for that, I'm very grateful. Thank you very much, Ed, for asking me. I really enjoyed being here again. Thank you.